Healthy Alternatives. Both research and real-life experiences are making it clear every day that our traditional medical system and practices need to be rethought, revised, and recharged in light of a more holistic approach to health. Dr. Jerry V. Teplitz, host of Healthy Alternatives, has been a pioneer for 36 years in stress management and optimum health. With a Ph.D. in holistic health sciences, a law degree, and as the author of 8 books, all focused on health, stress management, and performance, Dr. Teplitz is uniquely qualified to help us explore and incorporate healthy alternatives into our daily lives. He is a professional speaker and has shared his wisdom with over 1 million people. Join him to reach your highest level of health and wellness. Now, here's Dr. Teplitz.
Welcome to Healthy Alternatives. I'm Dr. Jerry Teplitz, and you're listening to WebTalkRadio.net. What Healthy Alternatives is about, most of us really want to reach optimum levels of health and wellness. We want to feel better, live longer, and enjoy life even more, and that's what I attempt to bring on each of the Healthy Alternatives shows. My guest I'm going to be talking to in a few minutes is Mark David. Mark is the founder of the Institute for the Psychology of Eating. He's a visionary teacher and consultant in nutritional psychology. He's authored Nourishing Wisdom, The Slow Down Diet, and Mind Body Nutrition. And he teaches students and professionals how to effectively work with the most common eating challenges of our time. And we're going to be talking about all that in just a few minutes. Every week, I like to begin the show by talking about an issue or concern you should know about because it can have a real impact on you. What I want to talk to you today about is the flu vaccine. Now, the Center for Disease Control estimates that the annual toll of Americans dying from the flu is about 23,600 people. Turns out these figures are actually a fabrication. What the CDC is, they use a mathematical estimate based on the assumption that if a death certificate had respiratory or circulatory disease listed as a cause of death, then it should be counted as a flu-related death. Now, in the Journal of the American Physicians and Surgeons, they have been highly critical of this CDC methodology. As a matter of fact, data from the National Center for Health Statistics shows an average of just 1,300 actual flu deaths per year. That is around 5.7% of the CDC estimate of 23,600 deaths. And in 2012, the National Center for Health Statistics showed that only 500 deaths were directly attributable to flu. Now, a meta-analysis was published in the medical journal Lancet and found that 2.7% of people who did not get the flu vaccine got the flu. That means that 97.3% of the folks did not get it in the first place. Amongst vaccinated adults, only 1.2% did not catch the flu. This means that having 100 people vaccinated results in only 1.5 people preventing them from catching the flu. There's also no evidence that the flu vaccine provides any protection for adults 65 or older, even though those folks are one of the groups targeted by the flu vaccine campaign. Now, in Canada, researchers found that people who got the flu shot were more likely to get infected a year or two ago, with be infected with the H1N1 pandemic virus than people who didn't receive a flu shot. In addition, flu shots in this country also contain mercury, and mercury is also highly toxic to the brain. So what can you do if you want to prevent the flu and you don't take a shot? Well, first of all, most folks won't get the flu. But the way to build up your immunity is taking vitamin D3. And if you do become infected, Dr. Wright recommends 25,000 IUs per day of vitamin A, not beta-carotene, but vitamin A. You can also look at taking astragalus and echinacea to help you ward off the flu. So maybe getting a flu shot isn't what you really want to do. If you want to know more about me, Dr. Jerry Teplitz, you can follow me on teplitz.com and Facebook. I also have a website at teplitz.com, and on there I have a free monthly e-newsletter that I publish called the Teplitz Report. It's health, nutrition, wellness oriented, different from what I put on Healthy Alternatives. Go to teplitz.com, and you should be able to click on the Home About button and sign up. Every week, I like to talk to you about a healthy breakthrough. It's the latest information, newest research on healthy alternatives you can use for yourself, your family, and loved ones. What I want to talk about is the research that's now out there on a vegetarian-vegan diet. Now, a recent report found that people who were vegetarians and vegans had a significantly longer life expectancy. They lived on average almost 8 years longer than the general population, which is similar to the gap between smokers and non-smokers. Let's look at some of the major leading causes of death and how switching to a vegetarian diet helps this number. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in this country. A 35-year follow-up study of the Harvard Nurses Health Study was recently published. They found that dietary cholesterol intake, which was only found in animal foods, was associated with living a significantly shorter life. Also, fiber intake, which can only be found in plant foods, was associated with living a significantly longer life. As an example, consuming the amount of cholesterol found in just one egg a day may cut a woman's life as short as smoking 5 cigarettes a day for 15 years, and eating a daily cup of oatmeal extends a woman's life as much as 4 hours of jogging a week. So imagine adding jogging for real to the oatmeal. Over 20 years ago, Dr. Dean Ornish showed that heart disease could not just be stopped, but actually reversed with a vegan diet, that he found the arteries opened up without drugs or surgery. Let's take a look at cancer, which is the number 2 killer in this country. All incidence of all cancers combined is lower among vegetarians. There was even a paper published in the journal Meat Science, which recently asked, should we become vegetarians or can we make meat safer? Well, instead of looking at making meat safer, just become a vegetarian. Dr. Ornish's team also showed that the bloodstreams of men eating vegan for a year had nearly 8 times the cancer-stopping power. And in a series of experiments, they showed that women could actually boost their defense against breast cancer after just 2 weeks on a plant-based diet. Now, the third leading cause is related to lung diseases, COPD, emphysema, things like that. And COPD can be prevented with the help of a plant-based diet, and it can even be treated with plants. Now, strokes. Strokes can be prevented by eating potassium-rich foods. And guess what you get with a vegetarian diet of green leafy vegetables, beans, dates, things like that? You get a lot of potassium. Even Alzheimer's has a difference in meat versus non-meat eaters. Those who eat meat, chicken, and fish appear to be 3 times more likely to become demented compared to long-term vegetarians. Diabetes, same thing. Plant-based diet helps prevent, treat, and even reverse type 2 diabetes. And just to round things out, kidney function problems, kidney failure, Harvard research has found that the three leading causes of dietary risk are animal protein, animal fat, and cholesterol, which you don't get in a vegetarian diet. So what we're talking about here is taking a much closer look at the impact of a vegetarian, vegan diet for yourself, because it can have a profound impact on your longevity. Just so you're aware, I'm now 42 years into being a vegetarian, and I don't look, feel, or act my age, which next month is going to be 66. Before I bring on my guest, Mark David, I'd like to talk to you about a book that can help you live longer as well. That's Managing Your Stress in Difficult Times, Succeeding in Times of Change. You're not aware of it, but that book is actually an autobiography done in the things that I use in my life to handle those stresses that I experience, so that living longer becomes a part of what takes place. If you'd like to learn more about that book, you can go to teplitz.com, click on the products button, and go into books. In addition, you can purchase it on amazon.com. Managing Your Stress in Difficult Times, Succeeding in Times of Change.
My guest today is Mark David. He is the founder of the Institute for the Psychology of Eating. Mark is a leading visionary, teacher, and consultant in nutritional psychology, and he's author of the classic and best-selling works Nourishing Wisdom, The Slowdown Diet, and Mind, Body, Nutrition. He's previously held senior consulting positions at Canyon Ranch Resorts, the Johnson & Johnson Corporation, and the Disney Company. The focus of his institute for the psychology of eating is really to teach students and professionals how to effectively work with the common eating challenges of our times. So, Mark, welcome to Healthy Alternatives.
Thank you so much, Jerry. Good to be here.
So where did your passion for nutrition come from in the first place?
It's actually pretty amazing that I can remember. It was actually in infancy. I was sickly as a child, asthmatic, almost died a number of times in the first, you know, handful of years of my life. Was taken from doctor to doctor with no success. And right around the age of five, I had heard a rumor that fruits and vegetables were good for you. I was raised in the late 50s, early 60s on Fruit Loops and Kool-Aid and marshmallow fluff.
All the good stuff.
My mother changed my diet at my request. Coincidence or not, my health changed, and from there I was off to the races, because I had this sensation in my body and this magical experience in my mind. Wow, I have some power here. What goes into my body has an effect on my health.
It's pretty amazing that a mom would listen to a little kid saying, change my diet.
It is pretty amazing. And, you know, I'm grateful for her, and we used to laugh when we would think about, you know, I was literally raised on all the TV dinners and all the artificial foods. And as soon as that started shifting, my life and health changed dramatically.
That's great. Now, when did you start the Institute for the Psychology of Eating?
The Institute began about 6 years ago. You know, honestly, I have been traveling, you know, all over the planet, lecturing, teaching, and at one point I thought to myself, huh, I don't want to get on another airplane for a while. And truly, it was a calling, it was a mission to start to take the body of work that I had developed and make it more formalized, make it potent, make it more concentrated, make it more powerful. So the inspiration was, you know, again, it was born out of a sense of calling, out of a sense of mission, and out of a sense of need. There is a heck of a lot of suffering that I notice that people experience around weight, around body image, binge eating. And there's not always a lot of wisdom and useful information coming out about how to be with all of that.
Now, with your institute, I'm familiar with people talking about the mind-body connection, but you focus in on mind-body nutrition. Can you explain to my listeners what you mean by that?
Absolutely. So this is a field I originated when the mind-body sciences first started becoming popular, you know, probably in the early 80s. I got excited to think, wow, is there a mind-body-nutrition connection? Is there a way that how the mind operates, how we think, how we feel, how we believe, our level of stress or relaxation, does that indeed affect how we digest and assimilate and calorie burn a meal? And sure enough, when you start to go into the research and when you start to poke around and prod around, the connections have actually been made for about 70 or 80 years, that indeed your mindset and especially levels of stress and relaxation will have a major impact on whether you retain vitamins and minerals, whether you excrete them, how potent you calorie burn or not.
Yeah, I remember years ago reading a study where they had kids who liked spinach and kids who hated spinach. Mm. And both of the groups of kids ate the spinach, but then they analyzed what nutrients did they absorb as it was going through their body. The kids who liked the spinach absorbed most of the nutrients. The kids who hated the spinach absorbed almost none of them. So that goes right along with what you're talking about in terms of that connection there.
And, you know, Jerry, it sounds so unscientific in a way when we cite studies like that, but truth be told, there's been a number of fascinating ones. And, again, it just shows the power of mind and emotions to affect metabolism. It's pretty magical. It's pretty amazing.
So how, from your standpoint, does stress, nowadays people are under lots of it, affect their health and their metabolism?
When our stress response is activated, now stress response is activated if the lion is chasing you. It's activated if you're having a rough day, if you're thinking self-attacking thoughts, if you're having issues with the kids, with the husband, with the wife. Brain doesn't distinguish between a real or imagined threat. So when stress response is activated, we're in sympathetic nervous system dominance. In that moment, if we're in full stress activation, digestion and assimilation is automatically shut down. So literally the moment that you are running from the lion and you're in a full-blown stress response, the simple way that the nervous system is wired is it shuts down digestion and assimilation because you want all of your metabolic energy when the lion's chasing you going into survival. So the point is when you and I are rushing in the car to get to work, chowing down our food, and we're in any degree of stress, we are in some degree of digestive and nutrient assimilation shutdown. And there's all kinds of research on this. It's pretty profound.
So why don't you talk about the reverse side, which is about, you know, the notion of relaxation and how that's then impacting our metabolism.
Well, just as, you know, life tends to occur in opposites, male and female, and yin and yang, we have a left brain and a right brain. We have a sympathetic and a parasympathetic nervous system. When we're in a relaxation response, when you're just, I'm okay with life, this is good, I'm chilling, I'm in love, I'm okay, I'm feeling nourished, that's, I'm going to call relaxation response. We are in parasympathetic nervous system dominance. When the parasympathetic nervous system switch is turned on in our brain, we automatically are wired for full, healthy, digestive, and assimilative, and believe it or not, day in, day out, calorie burning power. So it's literally a nervous system wiring. We are designed by nature, by evolution, by the wisdom of the universe to manage a meal and metabolize it most fully when we're relaxed, which sounds counterintuitive because a lot of people think, well, I'm stressed, which means I'm a lean, mean, calorie-burning machine because I got all this energy. Well, actually, no. It's quite the opposite, which is why oftentimes people who have literal digestive issues or heartburn, heartburn is very commonly connected to fast eating, which is a stressor for the body, or eating under stress, which will literally cause the digestive system to malfunction.
I assume you wouldn't recommend people to watch the evening news while they're eating dinner.
You know, funny you should say that. I had a client who couldn't fall asleep, and he would eat late at night, and he had insomnia. And the guy was on every kind of sleep medication, every kind of sleep study. Bottom line was, when he first saw me, what I discovered was that for about an hour and a half before he'd go to sleep at night, he'd lie in bed, he'd eat, and he'd watch CNN. And the war on terror and the war here and the war there would just get him so aggravated. As soon as we stopped him watching TV at night, he started falling asleep, and his digestive issues disappear. So to your point, not such a good idea.
Not such a good idea, no. Now, you also talk about what you call metabolic power of slow. Can you explain what that means and how it relates to what we're talking about?
Yes.
Does that mean you have to talk slowly, too, by the way?
You know, sometimes I do to figure things out. I think as a world, we tend to move pretty fast. And we tend to value high speed. We like high-speed cars. We like high-speed internet connections. I know I do. We want to get things done quickly. Time is money. And this sense of speed being sexy, although interesting and useful, takes its toll when it comes to the eating experience. And what I mean is the body, the human body, is not designed to eat a meal quickly. You'll often hear, and this comes from dietetic research, from all the dietitians, they'll say, hey, it takes the body approximately 20 minutes to realize that it's full, which is a simple way of saying that the body needs time to scan a meal, the brain needs to scan a meal. What have I just eaten? What's the nutrient profile? What did I just get? The brain needs time to figure out what the heck is going on nutritionally in the body so it can regulate appetite and regulate metabolism. So if I'm moving fast, because I'm eating fast, I'm in a rush, and how many people do I meet who consider themselves fast eaters? And what often happens is if you're a fast eater, chances are you might be complaining that I overeat. And you complain that you overeat because the brain needs time to regulate appetite. So as we learn to literally slow down with food and get present, notice, take more time, we actually drop into natural appetite regulation, and all of a sudden people who thought they had a willpower issue discover that they don't have a willpower issue. The problem was they weren't really eating in the first place. We weren't paying attention.
So before we continue, I'd like my listeners to pay attention because you're listening to Healthy Alternatives with Dr. Jerry Teplitz on webtalkradio.net. And we'll be back with my guest, Mark David, in just a moment.
Do you work under fluorescent tubes? What you're under is a cool white fluorescent tube. There is now available a full-spectrum fluorescent tube that does not have that weakening impact. We actually have a supplier. We know we can trust that you're actually getting a full-spectrum tube because you can get these types of tubes that are called full-spectrum at Lowe's and Home Depot. Turns out that they're not full-spectrum. If you want to learn more about this, watch some video testimonials from our clients. Go to teplitz.com, click on products, and go into lighting products. Full-spectrum tubes, bulbs, floods, compact spirals. Take a look. You're going to love them.
So my guest today is Mark David. He's the founder of the Institute for the Psychology of Eating. He's a leading visionary, he's a teacher, he's a consultant in nutritional psychology. He's authored the books Nourishing Wisdom, The Slowdown Diet, and Mind, Body, Nutrition. And he really aims at his institute to teach students and professionals how to effectively work with the most common eating challenges of our times. So Mark, I want to pick up where the notion is somebody is having trouble trying to control their appetite. Is it related to willpower, or is there something else going on under it?
Honestly, Jerry, I don't think I've ever met a person that has truly had a willpower issue, i.e. they're a willpower weakling when it comes to controlling their appetite. And indeed, especially in the weight loss universe, that's what everybody's worried about. I've got to control my willpower. I've got to control my appetite. First of all, your appetite's wonderful. Thank goodness you have an appetite. It reminds you to eat, because if you forgot to eat, you wouldn't last too long. what is happening for most people is there's something called the cephalic phase digestive response. That is a fancy scientific term for how the brain manages and regulates taste, pleasure, aroma, satisfaction, and visuals of a meal. It just so happens that when you sum total up all the research on this cephalic phase digestive response, it turns out that 40 to 60% of our metabolic power to digest and assimilate comes from this head phase of digestion, tasting, the aroma, your experience of the meal. If we don't get taste, pleasure, aroma, satisfaction, the brain goes hungry. It says hungry. It says, I don't remember eating, because those are literal requirements of the brain and of the body. So if we miss those, we think, oh my goodness, I'm hungry, but I just ate a big meal. I must be a willpower weakling. And once again, no, all you needed to do was slow down and take more time and get present.
So that where commercials for food would come into play, where they're giving you the visual cues, but you're not getting anything else, and so they're giving you that urge that's unfulfilled to go out and buy their product when you see it.
Yes, and the bottom line is, you know, a lot of people will go for it. They'll say, okay, well, I'm going to eat the chocolate cake. I'm going to eat the ice cream. But then when they eat it under stress. They eat it while thinking negative thoughts. Oh, my God, I shouldn't eat this. It's fattening. It's really bad for me. I'm going to gain weight. I really shouldn't be doing this. While you are doing that, you are not experiencing taste and pleasure and aroma and satisfaction because the mind is distracted and because we're programmed at the most primitive level of the central nervous system to seek pleasure and avoid pain. When you don't get the pleasure you're seeking from an experience, we'll continue to hunger for it. So you can get that cue, eat that food, but if you're not there or if you're self-rejecting or if you're distracted, we will physiologically be driven to eat more.
So companies who give their employees a half hour for lunch are not really doing them a service from a long time, not only health standpoint, but also performance on the job standpoint then.
I believe so. You know, here in the United States of America, if you eat your lunch in 2 minutes at your desk while you're working, you're considered an absolute work hero and you're a good employee. If this was France or Italy and you ate your lunch in that same way, you'd be considered a barbarian. You know, Europeans and other cultures do it rather differently. So, yeah, I think we tend to suffer when we put nourishment and eating and time for food, when we put that, you know, low on the totem pole.
What about the notion of amounts you eat, times of day, where I've seen some studies that have talked about having a bigger meal at lunchtime, which a lot of cultures do, and a very light meal for dinner, is actually better for our whole digestive system and our whole functioning that way?
You know, Jerry, I'm going to say on average that's true, and it's based on some very, very simple science. And the simple science, you know, people have heard the term circadian rhythms or biocircadian rhythms. There's a very specialized field in science called biocircadian nutrition, and it looks at how the body calorie burns and digests and assimilates differently at different times during the day. It just so happens that across the board of all human beings, you are most metabolically hot. You have your most powerful digestion between the hours of about 12 to 1:30 in the day, i.e. that's your peak metabolic calorie-burning digestive power hour. And to your point, that's why so many cultures naturally have their biggest meal at that time, because they're taking advantage of the simple biological fact that that's when I'm the leanest, meanest calorie-burning machine. So why not have your biggest meal then? Check this out. Sumo wrestlers, you go back hundreds and hundreds of years to Japan when they didn't have Ben and Jerry's ice cream. You know, how did they gain all that weight?
Great at night.
Traditional sumo wrestlers, yeah, they ate more, but they ate as much as they could at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. They'd wake themselves up at night and eat tons of food. taking advantage of the fact that between the hours of 2 and 5 in the morning, that's your slowest calorie burning hours.
Well, I guess you have to make a lot of sacrifice if you want to be a sumo wrestler.
It's true. And if you're the kind of person that's, you know, skipping breakfast and eating a small lunch and having a huge late dinner, then you're actually on the sumo diet.
Right. So you're seeing also a connection between breathing, oxygen, nutrition, health. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. When I first, at some point when I was practicing in my early 20s and I got into yoga, I just had the notion to practice breathing exercises with some of my weight loss clients who couldn't or didn't want to exercise because they had too much weight. And when I started to notice that people who would diet and not lose weight, all of a sudden I would just give them breathing exercises to do a couple of times a day, and lo and behold, within a few weeks, they lose 10 pounds. You know, and these are clients who had about 50 pounds to lose. Well, it turns out that this is junior high school biology. Food plus oxygen equals calorie burn. Much of the benefits that we get from actual aerobic exercise is increased oxygen uptake and increased ability of the body to utilize that oxygen. So the bottom line is, if we're shallow breathers, if we're not getting enough oxygen either through exercise or through the fact that we open our windows, through a little bit of movement, a little bit of deep breathing, if you don't get that, you will literally diminish your calorie burning capacity. The opposite of that is the more oxygenation you have to your system, and by the way, you will naturally breathe deeper when you're relaxed. We will naturally breathe more shallow when we're stressed. So it also gets back to this notion of stress and relaxation, which will regulate our breathing. So the bottom line is, if I pay attention, even while I'm eating, to my breathing, and let my breathing deepen, and let it be more regular, rhythmic, and deep, you're actually taking in more oxygen, which is going to help you metabolize and assimilate better, help you calorie burn better, help you drop into a state of relaxation response better, which improves your overall digestion and metabolism. You can't beat oxygen.
So do you actually teach people to do some kind of breathing exercise before they eat then?
For many clients, for many people, yes, it's try this out. That's how I suggest it to people. And honestly, the simplest way you can do it, especially if you have digestive issues, especially if you're an overeater, especially if you're wanting to have a stronger metabolism, 5 to 10 long, slow, deep breaths right before you eat a meal or a snack. Simple as that. And do that, and then notice what happens. Notice what happens to your appetite. Notice what happens to your digestion. Notice how you feel. It's a powerful state change. It's a state change for the brain and for the body both.
What do you see as the biggest struggle people face when it comes to the emotional part of eating?
It's a great question. I have noticed that the biggest struggle people face with emotional eating is that they tend to label it as awful, terrible, bad, I'm a loser, how could I be emotionally eating? Whereas in my view, we're emotional beings, and we tend to bring our emotionality to every place we go. So emotional eating could mean I eat celebrating, I eat while happy, I eat because I love this food. That's emotional eating. And sure, I had a rough day, and I might choose to stuff my face with food. That's emotional eating, but you know something? There's a reason we do that. There's a logical motivation for that, which is food helps us feel better. Food creates an endorphin release in the body. Food is literally substitute love for the brain. So instead of fighting the emotional eating, and I'm kind of summing up a lot of work into just less than a minute here, instead of fighting it, what if we learned how to welcome it? What if we learned how to say, wow, why am I doing this? Does this actually work for me? Because sometimes emotional eating works. A lot of times it doesn't. But when you stop the fight and stop the stress, we actually can manage the emotional eating better when we're not in judgment about it.
So for listeners who'd like to pursue what Mark David is talking about, you can go to his website, psychologyofeating.com, psychologyofeating.com. Mark, can you just tell my listeners briefly some of the things you have on your website, because you've got some free stuff they can take a look at as well?
Thanks so much for asking. Go to the website. We have a free video guide. It's called The Dynamic Eating Psychology Breakthrough. I discuss principles that are applicable to all of us who are eaters, which I think is all of us. And also, these are the same principles, many of them, that we teach in our professional eating psychology coach certification training. So for those listeners who are already a practitioner, helping practitioner of some kind, or are interested in the field of eating psychology, certification training, it's a distance learning program. It's very powerful, very unique. Nothing else like it in the world. We teach our professionals how to work with weight, with body image, overeating, binge eating, and all the nutrition-linked health challenges. So go to the website, get the free video guide, psychologyofeating.com, and there's also all kinds of information on the website in terms of blogs, and just a lot of great content.
Mark, thank you for being a guest today at Healthy Alternatives.
Jerry, thank you.
My guest next week is going to be Julie Hill. She's the executive director of a humanitarian organization based in Norfolk, Virginia, called Outreach Africa Lost Boys Foundation. It's an all-volunteer nonprofit that serves the Sudanese refugees that came to this country called the Lost Boys and Girls of the Sudan. And we're going to be talking to her about how she became involved, the impact that they have on the education of the children who came here, and also their relatives back in Africa, and the attitude that people who have gone through severe crises and having death all around them, how they can still stay positive. You're not going to want to miss this one. This is Dr. Jerry Teplitz. You can find out more about me at teplitz.com, or you can follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today for Healthy Alternatives. For more information about Dr. Teplitz and his availability for speaking engagements, please click on the globe on the webtalkradio.net page in front of you, or go to teplitz.com. You may also follow him on Facebook and Twitter by using the icons on the page. To find out more about his books, please click on any of the book covers you see. Eat well, rest well, take a breath, get some exercise, and we'll see you again right here next week for another edition of Healthy Alternatives.